This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Travel Tales podcast. The winners are the people with the most stories.
One of the great things about traveling is the people that you meet.
I've slept in bus stations, I've slept on people's floors.
And it's already on fire, and then there's just a gigantic, huge explosion, like out of a Hollywood movie.
It's not right or wrong, it's just different.
We hired like 10 Chinese prostitutes to come be our audience.
We were kidnapped by nuns in Puerto Rico.
Not a good idea to be high when you're packing. You forget a lot of stuff.
I got swine flu.
By the time you've lived through it, it's just a good story.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Travel Tales podcast. My guest is Jack Rathmel. Before we get to Jack, here's a few announcements. Our website is traveltalespodcast.com. Go there. You'll find stories that I've written, stories that some of the guests have written. You'll see photos of the guests. You'll see photos of me around there. And you also see links to their social media and links to our social media. Ours is Travel Tales Podcast on Instagram. Go there, will you? That's the one we want to build up. So go to Instagram at Travel Tales Podcast. Subscribe there. We also have a Facebook page at Travel Tales Podcast. We're on all your streaming devices. And if you listen to us on one of those streaming platforms, please give us a good rating. That helps more people find the show and it boosts our presence there. So that'd be a cool thing for you to do. I would appreciate it. If you want to write me for any reason, you can write me at traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. That's traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. Jack Rathmel's people reached out to me. He's written a book, a memoir. It's called How the Rhino Lost His Horn. And it details his time spent in South Africa. He's an American guy, grew up in Pennsylvania Amish country, which there could be a book in that for sure. After high school, went to college for a year and it wasn't clicking, just wasn't digging it. He needed to get out and get away. And he signed up for a voluntourism trip, a 90-day voluntourism, as they say, trip to South Africa. And as it does with a lot of people, especially in that age, that very impressionable age, he was about 18, 19, it blew his mind to travel to a foreign land. And he made it his mission to go back, and he did go back, ended up enrolling in school in South Africa and stayed there for years. He now makes his home in London, and he's written this book while plotting his next move. And he was a nice guy. I enjoyed my time chatting with him, and I hope you enjoy listening to it. Here's my chat with Jack Rathmel. Live in London. What part of London are you in?
So this is kind of West London, Notting Hill area.
Oh, lovely.
If you're familiar. Yeah,
I am. Very lovely. I have friends in Chiswick.
Oh,
around
yeah,
that area. Very nice.
10 minutes away.
Very picturesque. Very London.
It is. And it's almost too picturesque because even on any nice weather day or on the weekends, you have to swim through tourists who are trying to get pictures in front of. And they, I don't know. You kind of get jaded after a while, but I'm telling you, some of the houses that they take pictures in front of aren't even that nice. You think there's a more picturesque one two blocks away. And they're like swarming these houses that are just normal residential houses. But people just, you know, they want to get the Instagram box checked off.
Was the Notting Hill movie, did that ruin it too? I mean, are there like scenes from that movie that like restaurants and
coffee
shops?
Yeah, this is a funny one too. There's about four bookshops that are the real bookshop that were in the movie. And, you know, people fall for it every time. There's,
there's
just on Portobello Road here is that market that it's filmed on, that a few scenes were filmed in. And, yeah, there's literally, I think, three authentic bookshops. And, you know, everyone's getting pictures in front of every single one of them. So
looking
no one
around
really
for
knows.
Hugh Grant. They're thinking Hugh Grant's going to show up any minute.
That's right. But so I, you know, after, for the first little while, it's kind of cool to be involved in all that and to see it all. And then you start to think, these guys are kind of suckers, but you know, we all are when we go to a new place a little bit. So I try and have patience. But
what brought you to London?
Well, my mom's half English, so I kind of always grew up being here anyway in England. And I was just coming up after my master's year in Cape Town. I did my master's at UCT. And I was just popping through for a visit, like visiting family and stuff. But met my now girlfriend and came over to visit her. After I went back to the US. And then within being here for a few days, Boris Johnson comes on the TV and says, we're in lockdown now. So it was one of those, we kind of had to make a call of, well, should I just stay here? Because at that time, lockdown may have only been another week. No one knew.
Yeah, no one knew anything. Yeah.
Right. least of all him, I think, least of all Boris. Yeah. And so I just kind of stayed, and then it was 2 weeks, and then it was 3 weeks, and then it was, you know how it goes. And then it's, yeah. Then you've been here for a few years. And
so your girlfriend's English.
She's half as well.
Okay. But she's a citizen there?
Yes. Yeah. So she just grew up here, and it just so happened that we didn't want to leave because we were having a nice time together. And then we didn't know if they were going to close the airlines or whatever. That was still kind of up in the air, or not up in the air. And so we just made the call to just let's bunker down here for a little bit. And yeah.
Well, how do you, if you're not married, you're still not married though.
No, not married.
Oh, so how do you, visas are tough to come by in the UK. So how do you manage to stay? You don't out yourself either. You know, if you're, if you're on the lamb.
I've been here illegally for the last 18 months. Americans get 6 months anyway. So it's kind of, Americans, there's a little bit of a special deal. So I wasn't in a rush but we actually, there's just a partnership visa, and that's what we have.
Oh, really? Okay. And you have to renew it like every year or something like that?
It's every like 3 or 4 or 5 or I don't know, something like that. It's not too regularly that you have to do that. But it's weird. It's kind of demeaning. You know, you have to go in and like, you have to prove that you've been together for X number of like 2 years, I think it is.
Right.
And so you have to like show them sort of, I know some people have had to show like text messages, like love you too.
Like your social media, you guys traveling together somewhere.
It's true. It can get not too intimate, but like they need to know that you're a real couple. Cause so many people just,
oh sure.
Like,
yeah.
Like you and me could just be married for the week and then I could bring them into the country. So you kind of have to show them like, yeah, this was when we were on the beach in Spain or whatever. And you know, you guys are in like bathing suits and it's a little bit, and you just picture the government official like, yeah, wait, hold on. He's like going to kiss her, but she doesn't seem to be too into it.
Right.
Like, I think they're faking it, you know?
That's funny. Well, I mean, it's kind of the same thing here with like green card interviews and things like that. I mean, but can you work there? I mean, legally work?
I can work. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you can.
Yeah. And I have a like NHS number and stuff. So I was able to get, you know, when the COVID, shot came out, you know, I had to go and sign up.
Great.
It was great. But it's weird being here with the healthcare versus back home. It's almost like it's easier for me as a transplant who has no business, you know, leeching off their system. It's easier for me to like function and get medication and all that stuff than it is back home, which is kind of weird.
It's eye-opening, you know. Isn't it? I mean, it's just like I always say whenever I travel overseas, and I've been asked the same questions all the time by foreigners when they ask about America. You know, there's three things they just can't figure out, and one of them is the healthcare system.
Yeah,
two is the electoral college.
Yeah, that's a good one. And we don't really figure it out either. Yeah. We haven't really figured. So
and
fair enough.
Three is the guns. They just can't. They can't wrap their heads around it. They just can't like. And I stopped explaining it after a while. I was really it's just nuts. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. And it's a very tough one. And I was reading your piece on your site about traveling in the Trump era, Romania you were in.
Yeah.
And that was after the first time you got in.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was so interesting. And it's so true. Like, I don't know, these places that you go to that have so much history and so much like they've been through it all. And America's just this kind of, everyone's watching on as America's just kind of fumbling over itself and can't figure out what to do. And we're kind of making a fool of ourselves a lot of the time, but it was definitely a weird thing. Like when I grew up and I would come over to England, like with my mom or to see family and stuff, it was George Bush. And for whatever reason, I don't know if you face this as well, but when you meet people abroad, they treat you as if you're like the chief of staff for whoever's president. And so
they want to ask
Trump,
you policy questions and stuff. Yeah.
Right. They're like, what was Trump thinking with the Muslim ban? And you're like, I don't know. Why are you asking me that? I don't know. And, or like, why did Bush invade Iraq? And you're like 9 years old, you know? I don't know why. Where's Iraq? And so it was, when I was in Africa, it was a little bit of a better phase because it was Obama. So that was, it was still okay to, you caught a little bit less flack.
Especially in Africa, you know, it was just like, it was a big deal, you know.
So I mean, I kind of caught it right in the sweet spot. But, yeah. But now you go abroad and it's like, you kind of have to just shield, you know, and you're taking a lot of
it's hard, man. You may want that second passport soon.
It's true. It's true. And I might.
I'm trying to get one. I don't know how I can swing it, but it's always be nice to have in your back pocket.
Yeah, for sure. Some of the European countries are pretty. They're like, you know, I think like Italy or something. You can pretty much, if you have a great, great grandparent.
Yeah, they did cut back on that recently. They're trying to, like, they're making it a little tougher just this past year because my friend, we did a show. He's been applying for, you know, through his grandfather or something, Italian citizenship. And they just made it a lot harder. Yeah. So he went through two, three years of trying to get it, and then they changed it in the 11th hour. And so now it's harder. Again, it fights all this kind of like, you know, people trying to get second passports and, you know, anti-immigration stuff, but also the backlog of these things.
It's true.
And Italian bureaucracy is legendary.
Even if you could get it, you have to wait 10 years anyway.
Yeah, they're brutal. They're brutal.
Yeah. 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 There are some countries that are slightly easier, but you kind of have to be willing to bullshit or like find some sort of seedy lawyer. I know. But like I was saying, I have a buddy who came over to visit me during COVID in England. And then he said, I wanted to pop into Barcelona. I'd never been to Barcelona. He's like half the Colombian. So he wanted to check out Spain. And I get a call from him like 2 days later saying, I met some girls on the beach. They seem pretty cool. Anyway, there's an extra apartment someone has, so I'm just going to live here now. So for like a year and a half, I won't out him, but he was just there, you know, kind of hanging out and managed to eventually get a visa. But there's kind of ways for people to do it if you're quite crafty, and but you have to be willing to be in that gray area of immigration kind of. You know, bending the rules a little bit.
Well, we should get to your journey and how you got there. First of all, let's talk about the book and how the rhino lost his horn. I like the story. Yeah, but I'm going to be honest and say I haven't read it.
Yeah, no, most people haven't.
And then I'll give you my Hollywood answer. But like, I loved it.
Put
it down.
It rocked my world.
So
no, that's okay. Most people have not read it, so there's no shame in.
Well, when did it come out, and what made you? So it came out. What?
Yeah.
Really? So literally yesterday?
It would have been tough for you to, unless you got an advanced copy. It would have been tough.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, So, is this self-published, or did you get a publisher?
I was looking at like the traditional kind of angle more for a few months, and then I ended up going with like a hybrid place here in London, like a small kind of publisher indie place, and I just thought. I probably could have just grinded it out and tried to find like the traditional route, which for people who don't know is you have to get an agent, which is itself its own layer of, you know, crazy
bullshit.
Kind of total bullshit and like, and ass kissing. And it's basically like sending out job applications where they say, don't expect an answer from us. If we get back to you, that's great. If we don't respond, it's a no. And then you just think, well, how long am I supposed to give you though for that? And they say it could take up to 6 months. So you just have to just sit around and wait. And even if you then get an agent, then they have to take your book around to publishers. So it's, you have to get through like multiple layers of kind of, you know, people that don't care about you that much, because why would they? And try and convince them. And I just thought, I don't want to be sitting around with this project for 10 years, because I could have maybe eventually gotten an agent, but it might take 5,000 emails or whatever. And so I just thought, I want to move on from this. I want to get this thing out. And there are some parts of it you can do without the help of a, you know, Penguin or HarperCollins or whatever. And increasingly nowadays, it's easier than ever to get a book out and into the world and online and get your name out there with social media and stuff. And so that was also what I noticed was that a lot of these publishers were kind of like 10 or 15 years out of date in the way they were even talking, or it just felt like they were still stuck in that kind of like legacy media era. They hadn't really caught on to like, people don't get their news from New York Times anymore. They're right, not all opening up the paper in the morning. They're like listening to podcasts like this, or they're getting it from Twitter. They're getting it from TikTok, you know, for better or worse.
Yeah.
And their book recommendations, even like they're hearing from about different things, not in some literary journal. They're hearing about it, on social media. And so I just thought, let's just go my own way and just get it out there. And then that way I can start looking at my next project or even just take a break. But I just, wanted to get moving with it. So yeah, that's the long answer, but.
And in the nutshell, it basically follows your journey from Pennsylvania to South Africa. And this was a journey of, you grew up in Amish country?
That's right. Yeah.
In Lancaster?
So I kind of joke in the book that like I'm not Amish, but I look it. And so there were lots of people who along the way who have kind of grilled me
you
about.
You look it.
I could be someone's
You're
cousin,
wearing the big
know.
Hat?
The half exactly. Beard. Some Jebediah's cousin, Ezekiel.
It was the overalls that sold you.
That's right.
That was it.
I just can't figure out why people keep pegging me as an Amish guy.
Man, maybe it was the horse and buggy you drove in high school.
Like, no deodorant for the last 18 years of my life. People are just parting like the Red Sea when I come into the room. But Amish country is kind of a random place for someone to end up in Cape Town. Kids from where I grew up don't really go to Africa for anything like that. But I had gone to a year of university at Temple in Philly, if you know it.
Yeah, sure. The Owls.
Yeah, that's right. But I just couldn't really get into it. You know, I was acutely aware of how expensive it was and how little I was getting out of it, which I think is what a lot of young people are feeling nowadays. Like this idea that you have to make some bet where you take on $100,000 of debt when you're 17.
I tell people, I don't have kids, but I have a lot of friends, you know, who have kids of college age and they're going through all this. And, it was just, I went to college in the 80s. And I love education and I come from a long line of teachers and I'm never anti-education, but I am anti going into six-figure debt when you don't really know what to do. So it's becoming... overly expensive, and these kids are coming out with a massive debt that they got to pay off for 30 years or whatever. And then that's why you're seeing an increase, at least in the States here, of things like community college, at least for the first couple of years. And it's not a bad deal as long as you can stand living with your folks.
Yeah.
I couldn't wait to leave at 18, but I went to a state school and even the little crappy state school I went to is now far more expensive. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a great school, but it was affordable because it was in state and it was subsidized by the state. But now it's even that is too much, and so it's just like, man, if they can't even go to a state school and afford it, it's rough. So you better
exactly.
And you saw that early on that you wanted. So it wasn't about I'm going to transfer to a cheaper school. It was like I'm leaving school.
Yeah, it was, and we did have community colleges around, but I was still right in that. I had enough of an ego where, and because the kind of university pipeline does a good job of making you feel like you have to go to a real university. Community college isn't cool. It's like, that's what the kind of dropouts and the loser, the high school, And so
the good news, I think, is that's changing. I think
because
people are acknowledging the cost.
Yes, for sure. But this was still right at that bubble where
I get it.
You know, all your friends are going off to school. And so you're like, no, I have to.
Yeah,
I have to at least. And I just could tell like a few weeks in, the electives that they make you take where it's like, some random
math.
Yeah.
Atmosphere.
Like, right. Or like cheese tasting or whatever. Maybe that wouldn't be so bad, I guess. I don't know if you'd like
that. No, that it would take. If that was an offer, I would have taken that in a second.
To that point, when I ended up going in South Africa, there actually was a course, but it's a wine region in Cape Town.
Oh, yeah, Stellenbosch.
So there was wine tasting. Yeah, I was at Stellenbosch.
Oh, that was
there was a
great
wine tasting class, and it was like, this is cheating. This is a real
no-brainer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, because they would make it like some students, there was also a making wine
horticulture
class.
Or whatever.
Yeah, so they would make it, and then we would be like, yeah, we can volunteer to be the guinea pigs. Sure, we'll take the.
Man, that's a great class. So South Africa was school. You went to school there.
That was later on. So I kind of left. So I was at Temple, and I just thought, I got to get out of here. I got to. This is a dead end. I'm going to be in $100,000 of debt, and my parents are going to kill me. I'm not going to be able to do this. So, but like I said, I wasn't right in the headspace just yet to do community college and just go live at home. I still wanted to do something cool.
Did you know what you wanted to study? Did you know what your major was going to be? Because I was kind of like stumbling through it. You know?
Yeah, I kind of thought like politics. So I was doing political science. But it was just funny, just the way people talk about it, at least where I grew up, very conservative kind of traditional values and everything. And if you said before you even got liberal arts out of your mouth, people are like kind of, you know, making fun of you, calling you kind of different sorts of slurs and stuff, you know, because it's just seen as this, like, what are you? Okay in the head? Why would you ever want to go and do something like that when you could be doing STEM? It's like, what if I don't want to learn how to code? What if I don't really care about that? And so it's very much seen, it's very like, you don't really tell anybody if you're doing liberal arts. It's one of those things.
But not at Temple though. I mean, that's back home, right? I mean, you were at a big city.
Yeah. University. No, not at school. At school, it was fine.
And you also kind of threw yourself from a smaller town into a big city, you know, which is also its own set of shock value. Yeah.
And it was more just that I couldn't justify doing liberal arts and it costs $100,000. Because I think people can say, like, if you're guaranteed to get an accounting job or whatever, or like a whatever, finance.
I had a buddy here who did that. His daughter went to grew up in LA in the Valley.
Yeah.
And didn't know what she wanted to do. She liked, you know, arts and the poetry and stuff like that. And she chose some like small, you know, college out of Boston. I'm going, and he showed me the bill and I'm like, you know, hey, if she wants to figure out, she wants to do poetry, that's cool. But she could do that closer to home. And actually she could do that at home.
It's true. There's
got to be a cheaper venue. Yeah. She could go to Chico State here in California.
That's the thing. I thought
go to a state school and figure out what you want to do.
Yeah. I thought Temple was bad, and then I had friends who went to some of these actual small liberal arts schools. Temple's not a liberal arts school.
So much money.
And they're like, it's $65,000 a year, not for a degree. And you think, who's paying this? Who are these people that can just do that? And so I could. Yeah, there was all this kind of these different dilemmas I had floating around. Still wanted to do something cool and interesting. And yeah, so after that first year, I just started looking into how can I get out of here? How can I still do something cool without getting into $100,000 of debt, basically? And so my mom was from England. Dad had been in the Air Force. So travel was kind of baked into the family. Like, and it wasn't that weird to just go abroad for different things. And so they kind of encouraged me to, like, you know, and that's big in Europe. You know, people do a gap year.
Yeah, I was going to say, you sound like you needed one.
Yeah, but that's the thing. In the U.S., it also has a stigma where it's like, oh, you can't leave school, you know, because then you have an employment gap on your resume, or, you know, all this stuff. So there's all these kind of different stigmas that people have. It's unheard of for kids my age.
I'm all for the gap year.
Yeah.
I'm all for it.
Yeah, I agree. And so I kind of needed to make my own version of that. And I thought, then I found out about voluntourism, which is this, basically you go and sign up for an NGO, do some charity work in a location of your choosing. And you also get to kind of tour around the area and see it as well. So you're not just like doing a Peace Corps thing where you're working full time at like building a town in Fiji or something. You kind of pay for room and board in one of these countries. And you work for 3 or 4 days a week, but then they kind of let you go and do your own thing too. And yeah, I ended up finding that. And that's how I went to South Africa, was just, they had a sports coaching one, a role. I kind of filtered by role because I didn't want to really do proper teaching. That sounded kind of boring. I wanted to be.
You didn't
want to
work in a field.
Right.
Build a kibbutz somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Which would have probably been more noble, you know, kind of actually building infrastructure or something.
What were you coaching? What were you doing?
Well, I had grown up. I'm a big tennis fan. And I grew up coaching tennis, And I realized, and so I was thinking, oh my gosh, this will be perfect. I'll just go coach tennis. Of course, you get there and the guy shows you like a dirt lot, and you, the dreams of being a tennis coach and coaching the next, like, you know, rags to riches story, you know, King Richard or whatever.
Yeah. Part of being a coach is you have to build the court. You have
That's right.
You have to pay for the asphalt.
You can start pouring it here, just kind of, stringing up the net and stuff. So I realized I'm going to have to just really make do with this. And, and it was funny that the kind of head coach there, like gym teacher, introduces himself as like the pastor to me on the first day. So I'm like, oh, hi, pastor. Turns out he's also the head of the school's religion department, which doesn't exist, but he's just made himself the pastor. And I'm like, what are we going to, so what's our schedule today? What are we going to do? And he's like, so you'll be taking the, you know, the fifth graders out after lunch. Me, I'll be taking them out. And he's just like, I'll be in my office. I have some work to do. And I find him later. He's taking a nap, or he's like, I caught him in the middle of a movie or something. He's like, oh, close that door. Get out of here. And that was pretty much the last day I saw him. So I was kind of thrown in the deep end, coaching at this school in, like, basically in the townships of South Africa, which for people don't know is a township down there is like a slum, like a favela, basically.
Well, it was that big one outside of Cape Town. I think it was like a million people. I
that's
can't,
right.
We drove by it. I remember we went into one of them when I was in South Africa. Yeah. It was really, it's
Khayelitsha,
shocking how huge
Khayelitsha
it
is. The big
Khayelitsha
one,
is, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and that, I kind of touch on that in the book as well. Just, you come in, you're this fresh-faced volunteer kid who thinks he's going to save the world or whatever, the next Mother Teresa, you know, and you land, and you're with all these other 19-year-old white kids from, like, Connecticut. And what are you guys going to do? And you get in the van, they pick you up in the van or whatever. And before you can even get to the city, as you would have experienced, you kind of have to drive by these townships. There's no way around it. And it's almost this weird psychological thing of, it's like a tax you have to pay on the way in and out, where you have to be reminded that this is real. Like, this is not a little tropical paradise. There's, as far as the eye can see, the tin roofs, and there's a million people in there, and you can see just the power lines kind of hanging, you know, and people are just wandering alongside the road, and it's pretty eye-opening for a kid from, you know, Amish country, where it's little kids run alongside the road in Amish country with their cow or something. It's harmless. And this is like, these are real people kind of just surviving, trying to survive. And that Khayelitsha was one of my first real, you'd never seen anything like it. You wouldn't have in the U.S. You know, there's nothing, we don't have anything to compare that to. And so the guy points over and he's like, oh yeah, that would be like the fifth biggest city in America, you know, or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'd seen some poor places, you know, I'd been around like in India and in Africa and things like that. But what shocked me about there was the, just like you said, the size of it. I mean, when it just kept going and going and going. And it was, and when they told me it was like a million people, I'm like, oh my God, this is bigger than Minneapolis. And it's all like tin roof shacks.
Right.
And for as far as the eye could see, just miles of it. So it was the work you were doing within the townships, or was it like you just had to go through them to get to where you were?
So there's Khayelitsha, and then maybe if you would have also known, there's kind of the Cape Flats, which is the big kind of flat expanse between, that kind of connects the peninsula to the mainland. And that's this big flat area where the airport is and where Khayelitsha is. And there's also kind of like half townshipy areas too. It's not all like the tin roofs. It's, some of it's just very poor. And I was I was right next to the township in one of those areas. They wouldn't have really let us in the townships. It's not worth the trade-off of risking kids' safety. So the NGOs a lot of the time don't even let you go in. A couple kids were working at different orphanages and stuff like that, but most of us were adjacent. And that was still risky enough. Even at my school, the first day they said, you know, there's barbed wire around the whole little kind of, it's like a one building or one room, one story little municipal building is the school. And then there's the dirt lot, which is where I taught. And the barbed wire is around that, probably the size of a football field in total. And they're like, yeah, don't leave this. When it's time to pick you up, wait at the front gate and we will come get you. Don't try and walk home. Don't try and, so even that was kind of risky enough for us, you know.
So how did they set you up with an apartment? Did you have to find one or did you have roommates? How did this work?
Yeah, you kind of go in and there's like dorm house, like there's no big apartment buildings that they've rented out or anything. It's because there's probably only 20 or 30 or 40 maybe volunteers at any given time. It kind of on a rolling basis. And there's just basically different Airbnbs that they've kind of, they use. And you're in there with 5, 6, 8 people.
Yeah.
So it kind of turns into a hostel vibe. And so that's in the book too. As you could probably expect, it pretty quickly turns into like Animal House because you're sending kids down there, 18 and 19 year olds. They can't drink back in the US. They can't drink.
Yeah, and there they can.
And so you can go down
there. It's a freshman dorm.
And the beers, by the way, instead of $5 or whatever at a bar, it's 75 cents.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous. And it's sunny out. And it's, you know, and people are away from there. Right. And they're away from home for the first time. And so that's not rocket science. So it's always
was it all guys? Was it all guys?
Some of the houses were unisex? Is that the right word? And then a couple of them were co-ed.
Okay.
And I was just with guys for mine, thankfully, because like the co-ed ones were just, yeah, I mean, they were the pinnacle of it. It was a real mess in there. So I talk in the book a lot about, you know, the volunteering was almost easy compared to navigating the social, you know, the kids are great that I was teaching, you know, they're just, you know what you're going to get. They're super excited. Gym's their favorite class of the day. It's a sports mad country. So they're all just desperate. By the end of it, I was literally just telling them, we're going to do relay races today because I didn't have any equipment. So,
yeah.
And they were loving it. You know, we would do tag and they would be just cracking up the whole time with laughter and giggling, and they were easy. And then you'd have to go home and kind of navigate basically like a sorority house or, you know, frat house of different drama and stuff. It was funny to see the kind of dynamics that popped up, just how the amount of sexual frustration was really remarkable.
I work on ships, you know, I work on a lot of cruise ships. I've seen, you put enough young people, you know, away.
Below deck, in a confined environment.
Everybody's going to sleep with each other at some point, it's just what happens. But yeah, how long was your commitment for this? Like when you sign up, like, is it a year? Is it how long is it?
That first one, I was only down for 3 months. To get into the country for longer than that, you have to have like a proper visa. You have to have so this company kind of wanted as many people as they could that wanted to come, the NGO. But obviously they didn't want to help anybody have to get a visa. They didn't want to have to sponsor people and whatever. So they would just tell us or tell prospective volunteers, just tell them you're a tourist and tell them you're visiting family and then you're going to be with us. And you can be up to 90 days if you're a tourist. Beyond that, you have to start really applying for visas and stuff. So it was kind of this weird loophole where it's very transient. Like it was just this revolving door of kids. And that was when I started to really get jaded about the whole industry, because what on earth? Like some people were there for 10 days.
Yeah. What kind of change are you going to make?
What child's life are you going to change in 10 days? You don't even know my name. Like how can you know the kids' names? And so I started to kind of catch on pretty quickly that people are pretty much here to hang out, which, you know, fair enough. But it was this kind of rude awakening of, I kind of went there thinking, I'm going to meet all these incredible people. It's going to be, it's like going to be the UN.
Yeah.
the future UN. And it really was mostly just a frat kind of thing. I kind of started to get pretty jaded about it pretty quickly.
And now you see why the Peace Corps is like, what, a 1 or 2 year commitment or something like that? It's like, hey, you got to be in. You got to stay there and really work it, you know?
I think if you're going to really embed yourself in a place and learn about it, because that was the other thing I kind of had to learn on the fly was how little anybody actually knew about this place, even by the time they left. you don't really know any of the history, and in the and you just know like, oh, all the poor people are over there in the township because it looks awful, like it's pretty self-explanatory. So we're just going to go in and like spoon them some food, and it's, you know, there probably is a microscopic level of help that you're providing to the country. At, you know, at some level, you are just being an extra body who can do stuff. But in terms of like meaningful kind of structural change, it's not at all. You know, you're not, we're not really making any difference. And I think there's even an argument to be made that we are just helping to perpetuate it. Cause like if the government knows that a bunch of volunteers are going to go down and pay money for food for this school, they're not going to help that school. They're going to say, well, the white people are going to come and give the food and bring donations.
Right. So it's a Band-Aid, but it's not really fixing anything.
Right. And we're kind of letting maybe someone else off the hook who should be doing this job. So there's all these kind of things.
Like your boss who's watching movies.
Right. Exactly. Well, right. That's it. That's it. And so, and we're, and that was the other thing in Peace Corps, which I did look into, but I just couldn't face the idea of going away for 2 years. I wasn't ready for that just yet. but I also, at least with that, there's a stipend that you get. And with this, you have to pay voluntourism, you pay. And so it was like, wait a second, we're paying and we're working. And yeah. And it was this, you know, kind of strange dynamic of, who's getting the better deal here? You know, what's going on here?
Is that an angle you take in the book, or is it like, okay, well give us, so we'll go back to the book and give people like, what's a good story, like a choice one that makes them like just one of the examples of something that,
As far as the volunteering goes specifically?
Or something in the book that, you know, said, you know what, any more of these experiences, I'm going to have to write a book about this, what's happening here.
Yeah, right. I mean, the big one kind of headliner, I guess, is the people can find the video on my Instagram, but I almost got eaten by a shark, which was a good one. And only because of my own stupidity. We went cage diving.
Yeah, I did that in Gadsby or whatever.
Yeah.
So what year were you there? Because I was there about like 2010. Because I was there about 2 months before the World Cup.
Oh, man. And
so this is kind of reminding me because I went on a trip. It was a group I joined. And part of the deal was through a woman that I knew. Someone she knows her and her husband own a nice resort kind of like down south, more toward Gadsby. But
yeah.
We were volunteering before the World Cup at a little township like this.
No way.
Coaching soccer and volunteering, but they would also, you know, and we donated a bunch of equipment and shoes,
that's
you know,
awesome.
Cleats
so
and
cool.
stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that was part of the deal, but we got to tour the stadium right before the World Cup, the new Cape Town Stadium, which it was great. But I mean, it was like 2 months before the World Cup, and I didn't think they were. I mean, the roads weren't finished. I mean, the airport was a mess. I was like, I don't think they're going to pull it off. Somehow they did.
Yeah.
But it was like they came down to the wire, man. And
there's still a road in downtown Cape Town that just never got finished. They were preparing for the World Cup.
Yeah.
And it's literally just an overpass that just is cuts off like a horror movie or like a post-apocalyptic thing. And, you know, that's just one of the exits. And so everyone's just driving by. And it's just, so there's a lot of that down there.
So, so we did a bunch of like, you know, day trips. So we did the Stellenbosch wineries. And then we did, we went down and did the shark cage diving down in Gadsby. So I did it. I got in the cage.
Yeah.
And I think they stopped it because I think they stopped chumming the waters or something. It was controversial or something.
Oh, really?
And there weren't enough sharks or maybe something. You can double check that, but I have heard that they may have stopped it. But I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, people think you're down underneath the water. I said, no, you're half submerged alongside the boat. And they bring bait in front of it, and then they say down, and then you go underneath.
That's right. That's exactly it. So you know it well.
Oh, you were sticking your arm out the cage or something.
Well, that's the thing. I you know, and this is I kind of touch on this in the book too, is the kind of influence that social media and stuff has had on us all, and how it's fried our brains. Because of course, when I get into this cage, I'm thinking in the same way any other teenager now I'm sure would think, like, well, how can I get more attention for this? This isn't cool enough. I need to film this and put it on the internet. And so I was filming, you know, just with my GoPro. And then I thought, well, the coolest thing to get that would impress the most girls is a shark selfie. Uh-huh. And so, you know, they sit down. You're exactly right. And but usually the shark's meant to kind of go like parallel to the boat. So it just kind of comes across and you as you're in the cage and it's like, oh my gosh, this is kind of in landscape mode.
Yeah.
And so I thought the next time they sit down, perfect. I'm going to go down, but then I'll just spin around and just get a, you know, get a selfie with the shark in the background. And of course, I kind of spin around and slip a little bit. So I just grab the outside of the cage, which as you know, that's the number one rule is you do not touch the outside
of the cage. The one place they can bite.
It's the one place they can get you. And I go around and he sat down. And I'm like, I wonder if the shark's passed yet. I don't know. I'm just kind of waiting here with the GoPro on me. And I hear this like clamp and I just figured they're bringing us up. You know, the cage is like being lifted up by the... And then I look to my left to see my buddy, to see what's going on. And I don't see my buddy. I see like a gray cone about 2 feet into the cage. And it's actually the head of a great white. And it's about 1 inch from where my hand was. And it had, I guess, because they were trying to bait them in with the chum, but also with like a tuna head. So they were throwing a tuna head out.
On a rope.
And and it would like, they wanted it to kind of make a pass. And I guess this poor little shark kind of made a misread on this tuna head and didn't see the cage behind it or something. I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt here that he wasn't attacking me. But yeah, it turned out that he managed to clamp onto the cage to the point where they had to pull us up afterwards because the cage I think was damaged and stuff.
Oh my
it got
gosh.
So badly. But that was, to answer your question, that was when I kind of thought I probably
did you get the shot? Did you get the shot?
I did get it. I did get it.
And all right.
Yeah, we can find it or I can even send it to you now so you can see it. But that was a real kind of what have I gotten myself into kind of moment. And it's all just and there's a bunch of stories like that in the book that are all just self-inflicted. You know, I would love it to be the case of, external forces keep screwing me over. 90% of it is just me being kind of...
An idiot?
Yeah.
An American idiot?
Yeah, that's right. Or like succumbing to peer pressure. As dumb as it sounds, peer pressure works. That's the real problem. You know, I'd love to say, I'm strong, but you can be pretty rational and well-reasoned. And sometimes someone will just say something that gets under your skin. You know, one of your buddies, you know, you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. I bet you won't. And all of a sudden you're bungee jumping, you know, which is, did you do that while you were down there as well?
I've done it in a number of places. I did it in New Zealand. And then in Victoria Falls, I did the cliff, walk off the cliff and the thing. And, I did it there. And, but did you get a chance to do, any other parts of Africa while you were there? Did you get a chance to explore or at least more of South Africa? Did you go to like the reserves or do a safari?
So we did some safaris as well. And there's some stories from that. We were on one of these game drives and they're just so fascinating. You know, these tour guides, it's an encyclopedia. You know, they can give you half an hour of fun facts on each individual animal. Like, oh, that's Jeffrey, that giraffe over there. He's one of the younger ones. He came from this and this and this place, and they can just really rattle stuff off. But it was really interesting because you get to the rhinos and all of a sudden the host kind of, or the tour guide kind of clams up. You start to ask a couple of questions and he's like, I can't tell you that. I can't tell you that. And it's because they're so protected down there. So that was a weird thing. You know, this tour guide goes from being very genial and kind of, you know, a great host. And then all of a sudden you think like, oh, I've pissed this guy off. I think he won't tell me, you know, you're just asking like, oh, that's the baby rhino. Where's the mother? And he's like, I can't tell you that. And it's because of the poachers, you know, the poachers started to sneak onto these nice safari trips that are wholesome family trips. And they were using them as like scouting missions to go prepare for a poaching raid. And so that was a weird, another little brush with the underbelly of you know, what goes on down there. And these, And then on the way back, the car wouldn't start as we were in the lion enclosure. And it turns out, which I didn't know, but lions can like their vision goes up by like 10 times at night, of course. And so they go from seeing you as just one big creature when you're in the truck, like one big thing that they won't go near. All of a sudden they can pick you out individually as pieces of meat.
The smallest, weakest ones.
That's exactly right. So that was another close call where, he's starting the car and the lions are like kind of coming down the hill, and but we did make it out okay. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I'm just wondering. It's like, so after the 90 days is up, did you come back? And is that where you, was your girlfriend another volunteer? Is that where you met?
No. So this was back when, this was 10 years ago now for that first trip. And so the saving the world thing didn't really work out. The Mother Teresa V2, you know, that I kind of
saved myself. You saved the tennis game of
that's
some,
right. That's
I saved right. The backhand. You that's saved right. the backhand that's of somebody.
Right. You know, but every little helps, you know, every, you know,
you did your part. Well
tend
done.
To the garden you can reach, you know.
Yeah. This guy can put some topspin on where it never could right. before.
And but I was just ripping the ball by the time I left there. I was just, I had on a rope, but yeah. So I came back and the volunteering thing hadn't worked out. And I thought, you know, my career as a philanthropist is probably ends here, you know, but I fell in love with the country as you would have known or experienced. I'm sure it's so unique. It's just the most beautiful place. You know, you have all this natural beauty, the wildlife down there. And also just, especially coming from my kind of political science interest background, it has so much really incredible political and cultural history too. And a lot of it really recent. Like I first went down, it had only been desegregated for like 20 years, which is crazy to think about now.
I remember it happening. You're too young, but I remember it happening. You know, it's still the ban on, you know, the artists that, you know, I'm not going to play Sun City and the whole,
that's right.
You know, I remember it falling and Mandela taking office, and it was an incredible time. I did go to the District 6 Museum.
Yep. That's
when I was
cool.
there. And, I tried to go to Robben Island.
Yeah.
And, we went out there and the seas were too rough and we had to turn around and come back. So I never got to go.
But that's, like they canceled that's a it. Really cool, fascinating thing.
I'd love to go see it.
Yeah. For people who don't know, Robben Island is like, it was their version of Alcatraz, basically.
Yeah. It's where Mandela was for 30 years. I don't know how long he was
and
there.
And so now it's turned into a museum where the ex-prisoners are now the tour guides. So you can go and that's a really cool thing to do if you're down there. The band was like, we grew up listening to Paul Simon in the house. The Graceland album. And that was a really famous, you know, a lot of these artists were really trying to, help
Lady
South
Smith
Africans.
Black Mambazo.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Still one of my favorite albums. Where was I? Sorry.
90s South Africa was very hot.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah. And just, I write, what they have down there is a big chunk of the Berlin Wall. And so it's kind of this cool symbolism of these countries that have toppled their divisions and everything. And they're now trying to recover. And it was a gift from Germany to South Africa, when apartheid ended. But it's strange. And I realized this as I was down there too. You kind of start to wonder if everyone talks about apartheid being over, but all the white people live on camps in Camps Bay and in the nice posh area, on the beaches and stuff. And then we can still see the townships and you start to wonder how much
it's still segregated. I mean, it's still, that's,
and so everyone tells
like
you
here.
Oh yeah, yes, it's true. It's true. It's true. But it is interesting how you can kind of see the people really want to whitewash history a little bit. And I think you even write about this in, at least I read it in your Romania.
The Romania,
piece as well.
It is. It's true. You can change it.
Yeah.
But the wealth still lies with the same 5%.
Exactly. And so, in effect, there's kind of still a de facto apartheid where the people that are still hold the power are still living in the same towns and you still can't get in there. Good luck trying to buy a house in there. There's private security rolling around. And so, it's still this kind of weird thing where everyone's high fiving about apartheid being ended and everybody's equal now, and you're thinking people aren't really that, and it's the same in the US, and so you really notice those parallels.
Sure.
A lot of this tension still bubbling right there under the surface. A lot of these
you
these
can't
real,
just like erase, you know, 300 years of oppression in 50 years. It just doesn't work.
As much as we'd like it to be true, and as much as like, you know, kind of,
especially when all the wealth is on one side, and then it's like you can't, you know, so. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, it's groundbreaking, but I mean, you got more knowledge in travel than you probably did that you would have gotten at school. So
right, right.
And that made you want to come back?
Yeah. And so the volunteering kind of didn't pan out, but then fell in love with the country anyway, and then ended up just as soon as I got home, it was like, that was way cooler than going to temple again. And I'm not going to sign up for that. I got to find a way to get back down there. And so I eventually found a way to do a study abroad in Stellenbosch. And so that's the next chunk of the book. And I was there for 6 months that time. And as you know, it's just this beautiful, it's kind of like the Napa Valley or something of Cape Town. Yeah. It's like the
wine region.
Yeah. And it's this really beautiful, but that kind of came with its own challenges as well. And really interesting cultural kind of stuff to dig into, because you have the townships and like the very cosmopolitan Cape and really, diverse population. And then you go out to the wine region, and it's basically like going back 150 years to kind of, the Deep South or something.
Yeah, where, the colonial
right,
life.
And it's still very much a part of the history and the culture there. And they almost take pride in being a bubble that's sort of, we don't worry about all that new, all those new developments that have happened. We had a good system here, and we're going to kind of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, there are so many parallels to the U.S. because what you get out there is they're super into their rugby. Like, whereas down here we have the college football and the kind of small town high school football stuff. And
rugby and cricket, man. I tried with the cricket. I really tried, but I couldn't. But
it's tough.
That was the other thing. the 90s Invictus. You know, that movie. I don't know if you saw that with Matt Damon. I always ask the South Africans, like, how did Matt Damon do with the accent? And they said, you know what? He did a good job with the accent. But they couldn't get past the fact that they knew Matt Damon's kind of short. And the real dude is like, you know, he's a giant. He's a mountain. You know, he's a huge dude. Yeah. He's like, yeah, but Matt Damon's too small to play him. He's too small.
Yeah.
He said he did okay with the accent, but he was just, the real guy is, he's big dude.
Hollywood's never going to let the truth get in the way of a good story, though, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they wanted their A-list guy.
But I've tried to, like, the South African accent, I've kind of, like, learned to hear, there's a couple words that gives them away all the time. You know, it's like, it's trying to decide between different places in England or something like that. Have you, like, gotten the accents down? Have you?
Yeah, and there's also, then once you get a little bit more in tune with it, you can hear the Afrikaans versus the English. Like, even if someone's white, you can hear the more like Dutch kind of a little bit more rugged sounding Afrikaans accent versus the English, which is a little bit more posh kind of their version of, it is fascinating. And what I found down there in Stellenbosch, it's very Afrikaans. So it's still very, Cape Town's a lot more English, and that's just where the influence kind of,
and international too. Expats there.
But in the South Africans in the city are the Afrikaners are closer, more inland is all I mean.
Yeah.
And so it was this funny thing where they actually, I could sense a few times some real tension, even with me. Cause you think you stereotype, obviously, unfortunately, but you think, oh, the kind of, these are the farmers, and they're going to be a little bit more, perhaps racist at best, a little bit close-minded. So any of the, and it was true, a lot of the places in Stellenbosch, like I went to some bars and some nightclubs and stuff, and they would just be filtering out black kids from the line, as you're trying to get into these places. And I was thinking, thank God I'm in the clear here, Amish looking Jack. but actually even that, I sensed some like tension a lot because,
you're an outsider.
And it goes back to the Boer War, where they actually don't even trust the English, a lot of these.
Oh, yeah.
And so, but there's these fascinating layers that in the U.S., we don't care. We don't know anything about this stuff. We just think of, it's all like black versus white, and like you're either one or the other. And that's where the lines are a little bit clearer as far as the kind of whose side everyone's on.
Well, you're an outsider.
Yeah.
That's all it is. You're an outsider. Yeah,
but it was interesting. It was like you have to really, but it went the other way too. Where, and to the point of the Hollywood kind of oversimplification, we kind of think of it as like, oh, apartheid means that the black majority triumphed over the whites, and actually, And so all of them must be on one side, and all the white people must also be one monolith as well.
Yeah.
But you go down there and you realize, actually, even within the black population, there's a million different old clan and tribal kind of rivalries.
Oh, yeah. That's,
and there's just
the tribal
much,
thing is very, you know,
right.
prevalent, you know,
right.
And like the leader, like the president is from a certain tribe.
Right.
So they're
going
to get preferential treatment. And then, you know, yeah, we found that
that's
out
right.
in the townships as well. It's
yeah.
very... I thought like, you know, going to Israel, like everybody, oh, everybody's on the same page. It's like, no, there's conservatives, there's liberals, there's atheists, there's
right.
like, you know, there's, you know, the moderates.
Yeah.
So you're going to get everything.
And that's weird though for us, you know, if you're just from the US and you, all you do is you kind of just know the basics about politics or anything, you go down there and that totally catches you off guard because people think like, that can't be right. Like we were told that like, all these people must love each other. They must all be, you know,
yeah.
they won the victory. And actually they can sometimes hate each other. This group might hate this group way more than they care about white people or something,
yeah.
you know? And so, but that can really blow your mind as someone who's going down there to like, I'm going to be a force for good in the world. And I'm going to show these people how generous I am. They don't want, you know, some of these people don't want to, they don't care about you. And
hey, there's your political science.
It's true.
Degree,
it's
right?
true. And so I kind of, there were all these different layers that you have to kind of navigate that you didn't expect.
So how long did the second stretch last? And when did you, how long before you went to England? And did you come back to the States at all?
So the second one was 6 months. And then I actually graduated university. That was my bachelor's. I finished my bachelor's.
Oh, okay.
Down
you finished.
There. Yeah. And then.
In 6 months?
Well, I that was a study abroad. So I came back from the first one, started looking around for schools because I knew I couldn't go back to South Africa right away. And I landed on Flagler, if you know it. It's down in St. Augustine, Florida.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
If you've been to St. Augustine or heard of it, but it's been a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's a really cool little town. It's actually, I think the oldest town.
The oldest.
Yeah.
One in America, colony in America.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Because it's got in kind of grandfathered in. It's a loophole because it was the Spanish who actually.
The Spanish came, yeah.
And it's this beautiful little town. But yeah, went there and then did my study abroad in South
okay.
Africa and had to kind of fight my way there because the study abroad complex, like the industrial complex in the US, is actually a real behemoth, it turns out. It's very tough to navigate it. And it can be that can also be really expensive, and you have to really be kind of savvy about how you do that. But lots of kids I know just keep paying their regular tuition in the US, and the schools in South Africa are like $2,000 a semester. You know, they're pennies on the dollar. And so when I went down to study abroad, and I had managed to find a way to get there just as an independent student, and so I was only paying the lowest rate, the standard rate. And these kids had paid, like we were saying, like $50,000 for that semester.
Yeah.
And just because if you do that, the school like takes it out of your hands and they handle all the visa and all that stuff. And people had no idea. So they were just.
So you could. So your last semester of Flagler.
Yeah.
You could just say, look, I'm going to go pay for this school in South Africa. But the credits were
That's
enough
right.
there to
it took,
transfer. So you get a $2,000 semester in your last
right.
semester?
And I got to
okay.
be in Africa. I graduated like online.
That's a good deal.
When I was on Lion's Head, if you probably did that hike.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I got my graduation email, you know, as I was on Lion's Head. So that was kind
of Table Mountain.
That's right. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so there's all these kind of, you have to be savvy because these university complex really wants you to just fork over as much of your money as you can or as they can get out of you. So I would feel bad for some of these other study abroad kids because it's just a ripoff. You just get totally ripped off. And
so you get your degree and you stayed.
Yeah. And then I came home again, had to come home again because that visa was only, a few months.
Sure.
And so I just keep having to scheme about how I can get back to this place. And so I was doing some tennis coaching for a while. Then I learned that the UCT has a master's program and applied to that. And I got in with that. And so then I was able to go for a year and that was a good, I managed
back
to buy
to
a
Cape
year.
Back to Cape Town for a year.
Yeah, that's
wow,
right.
Wow. Okay.
That's right.
Wow.
So I kind of, it was like this saga of going, and each time able to get a little bit more time, and then scheming once I was home of how to make it back down, and just trying to negotiate with all these different schools and just trying to make it.
Has there been a big South African tennis star? Because there's more like rugby, cricket, and golf. Yeah. Golf is much bigger.
Golf is huge.
In terms of pros, but I can't think of a South African pro tennis.
Ernie Els had a winery. Yeah,
Ernie Els and Gary Player those guys. Yeah. I mean, but in tennis, has there been a big South African star?
So when I was down there, have you heard of Kevin Anderson? He made a Wimbledon final or US Open. I think he was like 6'7", one of these big guys, Kevin Anderson. And then now there's a guy named Lloyd Harris, but no kind of top five guys, no like household names.
Yeah. Not like Australia or anything like that.
No, right. Right. But it's funny. I tried to join the team down there at UCT because as you'd know, the level to get into a D1 school in the US, you have to be like basically pro.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah. Like you don't get to play D1 unless you've pretty much been on the pipeline since you were 9 or something. It's like you do the travel teams, you do the academy, and then you go to D1. And it's a whole that's kind of an industry as well. But so I couldn't ever play D1 in the States. But in other countries, it's not like that. It's more of a social thing. Like you can just sign up and be on the team, and they divide it up. So there's tiers, but it's much more like you can go and try out, and then they just put you on the
It's a club. It's like universities are for playing sports. Yet, unlike here, that's the other thing people ask me about. It's like, wait a minute, 100,000 people went to a college football game,
right?
And I go, yeah. It's like that's bigger than like Real Madrid Stadium. I go, yeah, I know. And are the players getting paid? No. Well, now they are, but I mean, they can't figure that out. It's like, why don't you just like, well, you know, they get a free college. It's like, well, why don't you just make college affordable? No, we don't do that. You got to run with a football. To get cheap college.
Yeah, let's check his jump shot before we decide if he can get fed.
What if you're really smart? No. You got to be able to block.
In fact, that actually hurts you. In fact, we don't want you to be smart.
Right. You got to be able to serve a tennis ball.
But it's true. It's funny though, isn't it? How like these debates, like that college, the sports thing, we are stuck having some of the stupidest debates with people, or we have to explain some of the craziest stuff.
Yeah.
I don't want to even have to defend this stuff. And I have to
I don't anymore. Yeah, I just say, it's weird, right? Because it's like, save yourself some time, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
There's some things about America that we just took it for granted growing up, but now they don't make sense if you've traveled around a lot. And hey, every country's got stuff that doesn't make sense. So it's like, that's our burden to bear.
And it is, it's this weird asymmetry thing where, for better or worse, they just happen to, or a lot of these countries happen to just know a ton about us because we shove our TV down their throat and music and everything.
Our culture is everywhere.
So we go into a meeting with a guy from X country. He already knows all the weird stuff about America. We might not know about like Romania, for example. And so we're kind of caught with our pants down because we can't then come back and say, oh, well, what about your weird thing? So
what about that treaty of 1985?
Or your weird politician. Who's your version of Trump or whatever?
Yeah.
So we kind of have to sit there.
They've had 50.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's a funny thing you say that, because I would go down and I remember, like I was saying, facing some kind of a little bit of hostility from some Afrikaans kids down in Cape Town. And they would be giving me shit about, oh, America's racist and your politicians are so aggressive and kind of, and you think apartheid was 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Of all the people in the world who I won't take this from, it's going to be you.
Exactly.
Look, I'll hear it from, you know, someone from Spain or something.
I always try to, I always picture, I describe like America to people as like, imagine that big, fat, spoiled teenager.
Yeah.
Because we're so young. You know how like teenagers, everything hits them hard, you know, because it's the first experience of everything. Music, team, media, relationships, every breakup is like, I'm going to kill myself. And, because you're feeling everything for the first time. So you over-exaggerate stuff. And if you're rich, you know, you've been spoiled and, you know, you've had it pretty good.
Kind of gotten and your own way. Yeah.
And so now you're seeing, you know, a young a young kid experiencing real issues, and we inflate it. Everything's, meanwhile, old people are just patting us on the head. It's like, oh, what are you, 200 and something years old? That's adorable. That's hey, Italy, come over here. 200 years. What do you think of this? China,
exactly,
what do you
think?
Hey, look at that, 200. That's adorable. Yeah, this building behind me is 1,000 years old. So don't even, you know what I mean? So just like,
absolutely,
we've seen all this. You know, you're in next to Europe. I mean, you've been looking. Look how many different. Look at a map of 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, things change pretty fast. You know, and yeah, I remember touring a castle in Germany the first time I went there. And it's like the family lived here. I asked the guide, I was like, how long did this family who lived in this rule all these lands over here? And they said, about 800 years.
It's
like,
and it's just casual.
My country's only,
it's totally like, casual.
And in a time when people lived to, 40. So how many generations? There's like, oh yeah, these people always run it. It's just the way it's always been.
Yeah.
And then one day it isn't. Somebody with a bigger army comes in and takes it. And then there you go. Things change.
And that ties into what I was saying about the kind of clan rivalries and tribal stuff. Americans go in and we're only taught even in school, at least in where I grew up in kind of underfunded public schools across the country. If you're taught like 200 years of history, you're lucky. You know, it's pretty much American Revolution. You get a little bit of that, a little bit of the Civil War. And then you get like Martin Luther King, and that's pretty much, and my mom, she learned about in school here, 1066 and like William the Conqueror and stuff. And we don't even,
and they're trying to erase, what they're taught already, little we're taught, they're trying to whitewash it and erase it now. So it's a dangerous, so that's why it just keeps repeating.
Right.
Over. And humans aren't that smart,
And that's what you realize as well.
A bunch of apes with sticks walking upright.
That's right. And now phones. And now we have like super-powered computers that are controlling our minds.
The technology has evolved way faster than the humans.
Yeah. And I hit on that so much in the book, just this idea of travel and kind of going abroad is – it used to entail, like, it's a completely different proposition now, and our kind of ideas about it haven't really caught up. Like 100 years ago, travel kind of necessarily required an amount of discovery and adventure and effort. Exactly. You had to really kind of decide, I might not come back from this. I need to really, like, this is the trip of a lifetime. I have to really treat this as, and that's even to go like two states away. And now it's so frictionless and so kind of commercialized, and you can go to an airport in Dubai or Kenya or wherever, and you wouldn't know where you are. And you can say you've been to Kenya or Africa, whatever else, Asia. And really what travel entails now is a completely different set of things than it was before. And so just saying you travel now actually is no, we don't know anything about you. Whereas before, if you were a traveler, an adventurer, that guy's some. Yeah. He's done some serious.
Or you were rich,
right?
Or you were the 1% that could afford to, do that.
Right, and there's just, we kind of haven't quite caught up with just how instant everything is. I could teleport to like Mongolia, basically. I'd be back by dinner on Friday or something. And I think we just haven't quite caught up, and so we go to these places like. Volunteers like me or other kids go down to a place like Africa, and you combine that with we're only taught about 200 years of history. And so we're like, we're going to fix everything. We're going to be done in a week, and it's going to be great. Because that's what happens in America is like,
it's arrogance.
Right.
Arrogance combined with ignorance, which is a dangerous combo.
And that's really what I try and wrestle with in the book a lot is what place do we have at all to go to arrive in South Africa that didn't ask us to go there at all. This school did not reach out to me and say, we really need a gym teacher. I just thought, I'm going to take my talents to Cape Town and that's where I'm going to be a hero. And there's a lot of hubris in that. And I really try and wrestle with that. What does it even mean to be a good, a philanthropist or a good traveler or a good kind of tourist in the modern world. And half the people that are there are just there to collect all the good selfies so that they can and would
get your arm chewed off by a shark for the selfie.
Look, I'm as guilty as anyone. But this question of would you still go to that place if you weren't allowed to bring your phone and take pictures? And I think a lot of people would actually end up traveling a little bit less. Like, would you still go volunteering if you couldn't tell anyone you went? And that's a tough question, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah. So let's bring it back to travel before we wrap this up. And I just want to, you know, these experiences you've had, how has it changed you as a traveler? And where have you gone since? And where do you want to go? What are your dream destinations?
That's a great question. I've been back down to South Africa since. I've been actually twice since the book kind of has been finished in earnest. And that was a weird one because I had spent a couple of years writing about this place and I hadn't been in 4 or 5 years. And then I spent 2 or 3 years almost writing this book just straight through. And you're writing about this place and you're describing it and you're kind of trying to the imagery and trying to create all this environment. And then it actually got to a point where you almost psych yourself out where I was scared to go back a little bit because I'd almost created this place that wasn't real. You know, you kind of, it's almost like you imagine a girlfriend or something. And then when you actually meet them, you don't want it to be anticlimactic or like, oh no, you almost want to keep them as this perfect thing in the imaginary thing. But I went back and it was just as beautiful as ever. And so I'd like to do maybe some more stuff from down there, like a kind of an addendum type of thing. And just like where the country is now, because it's still in flux. As we were saying, you know, it's still very much a country trying to figure out, you know, and now you have China coming in and trying to pretty much colonize so much of Africa. So there's some really interesting political stuff there. But Europe, I have a soft spot for. I would love to write more about Europe. And I'd love to learn more about it. That's what I learned writing. You learn a lot about a place when you write about it, as I'm sure you have learned that as well. Like, just the research that you have to do, and you end up becoming kind of a lot more aware of a place and appreciating it, its history and culture as you write. So I, even just as an exercise in learning, I'd like to write more about Europe and. But you know, if that fails, I could write just about so much of stuff from Lancaster, PA, because in rural kind of Appalachia, you get some wacky, you know, some really good stories. And and so, you know, all else fails, I can kind of, it's low hanging fruit, you know, to pick on the, you know, kind of some of the bumpkins, but maybe I'll have to do it.
Well, aside from the weather, I mean, I love London, but I mean, the weather's a drag, but the greatest, you know, one of the greatest benefits of being there. I mean, you're central to pretty much almost everywhere in the world. I mean, you could zip off to Egypt for a weekend. On a cheap flight. I mean, you can go to anywhere in Europe and everything for just, you know, a little short trip. Get a Ryanair flight and go, you know, for nothing. You
it's
know, so
absolutely
have,
true.
I hope you're taking advantage.
I have. I've tried to. I've really tried to. Just the last couple of years, I went to Greece for the first time. I'm sure you've been to Greece, I think. And you talk about the history, as you were saying earlier.
Oh my gosh!
And that one almost is unfair. You know, at least you know, in some other, you know, you go to some other places, and even London, and like, oh, this pub is from the 1600s or Germany, and there, Greece just like, they don't even have to compete with England. It's like you, and I think that it would benefit so many people in America to see some of this stuff and just to try and get it into our heads just a little bit that we are so insignificant in the scheme of things. But if you, the kind of double-edged sword of it is if you don't leave, you can kind of stay in that bubble of like, hell yeah, we're the greatest.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah. And so I don't know what it would take. But going to a place like Greece or Athens and you just think, you know what, this is, it's very humbling. It's very humbling.
Yeah.
It's almost,
we're here and then we're gone.
Yeah. It's not like spiritual, but there is an element of you think how many hundreds of thousands of people have walked up to the Acropolis, like how many people have been on this little stairway, you know, and you just, it brings you back down to earth very quickly, which I think is a a good thing for us once in a while.
One more time, tell people your websites, where they can get the book.
Yeah.
Instagram, and where can they follow you?
Yeah, I have an Instagram. People can find me, Jack Rathmel, just type that in, you'll find me, or it's just rathmel.jack is the username. How the Rhino Lost His Horn, and it's out now, and you can get it on Amazon and all your web-based bookstores and stuff. Anywhere people go to find books, it'll be there. And also, I just cut the price in the ebook because I wanted people to just get it. I don't care about the price of it. So it's super cheap. It's going to be like $2, $3 for the first month at least. I just want to kind of get it out
awesome.
There. So grab it, and you can, as long as you give it a 5-star, you know, I don't care. and if you want to yell at me, message me on Instagram or email me or whatever. But
what are you on Instagram? Is it your name?
Just Jack Rathmel. You can type that in.
Okay.
And that'll find me. Jack Rathmel, writer. Or How the Rhino Lost His Horn. That might even work. Just the title of the book.
We'll have links to all this on TravelTalesPodcast.com. And great. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it. Thanks for staying up later in...
It's not that late there.
Was it 9-something? 10?
Yeah, it's not so bad. You lose track of time after like 3 p.m. here. It's all the same.
I know, because it's so dark in the winter. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is fine. This keeps me awake.
Great. I appreciate you doing this, and good luck with everything, man.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Jack Rathmel, everybody.
I'm Pauline Frommer, and on the Frommer's Travel Show, we try to answer one important question. What's really worth knowing in travel today? From engaging destinations to ways to travel better, save more, and see deeper, and conversations with some of the smartest people in travel, from Samantha Brown to Andrew McCarthy, new episodes weekly on voyescape.com and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm David Brody, co-host of the Travel in 10 podcast. Together, myself and my co-host, Tim Johnson, have traveled to over 150 countries around the world and all 7 continents. Now we're sharing our favorite places, some of our best tips and experiences from all around the world in just 10 minutes on Travel in 10. Join us at voyescape.com.